This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We were in the middle of the explanation of Senate File 2, which, as we discussed at the end, we asked Senate Counsel did an engrossment of it, which is listed as A23, which should be in your packets or on your packets, and then the amendments, the individual ones, if you still want them, should be in your packets. And Senator Berglund, I would suggest what you do is finish going through the bill section by section, and then we'll have the – there were several people who wanted to speak. I'm not sure if it, with concerns or in opposition or some mixture of things. So.
And, Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I'm going to skip over the next part of the bill and come back to it because my other author is presenting in another committee, and it's not integral to understanding this exactly what order you presented in. So we'll skip over the prescription drug discount program until Senator Sharon is available.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. Are we working off the committee engrossment or the original bill and the amendments?
We would be working off the committee engrossment, and you should have the original bill and the amendments from last time there if you had them marked up and so on. But we will – it's easier. I think when I asked the committee at the end, I think the feeling was that working off the engrossment is easier for us to deal with.
Thank you.
So, Senator Berglund, what page do you want to – what section do you want to start with?
So we'll come back to the prescription drug program, which is Section 15, and we'll start then on Section 16. And this is part of creating a shorter application form. We remove a number of provisions from both the application form and from determining eligibility for the program.
That's the Section 22 of the engrossment, I believe, on page 23.
I guess I have my notes on the old summary, so I apologize.
That's okay. We can try and, if you read them, we'll try and catch which section there. But the effectiveness of that is just by eliminating all that language that it's going to be instead of 20
some
pages.
We have to do that if we want to get the enrollment form down to a more reasonable size. The next subdivision in my, or the next section in mine would be Senator Solon's, and this deals with the medical assistance co-payments paid under the Part D prescription program. And so while she comes up to the table, I'd like to call your attention to this short of charts. If you look at the we did them two-sided. So if you look at the one that's on the back of the hospital uncompensated care chart, you'll find one that says hospital emergency room visit trends. And you'll see that it's had quite a spike over the last year. We believe some of that is due to uninsured, but we believe that a great amount of it also is due to the Part D prescription drug program, which has large co-payments, as we heard from the testimony last week, for some of our most frail people. And so they're not able then to afford their drugs, and so they're ending up in the emergency room. Senator Solon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Berglund. Senate File 2, Section 17, establishes that medical assistance will cover copays for recipients.
It's Section 23 in the engrossed version.
Okay, Section 23. Will cover co-payments for recipients enrolled in a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan or the Medicare Advantage program. And then Section 21, do you want to go into that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Removes the co-payment requirements in the General Assistance Medical Care Program. Section 48 then repeals Minnesota statutes or the co-payments for medical assistance, but there was an amendment to this.
Make sure you still have me for emergency.
Yes. There is an amendment that was made to this that continues the copayment for non-emergency visits to the emergency room.
Now, this is Section 25 and 28, Senate Counsel says.
Sorry.
It's okay. So, in other words, what was the... So the copay will now be paid by medical assistance in all those cases?
No, the copayments will be paid by medical assistance except in the case of non-emergency visits to the emergency room.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then in the old summary, Section 18... requires the commissioner to develop and implement an intensive care management pilot program for medical assistance recipients who have complex and chronic medical issues or who have high risk of developing them and receive their primary care through a federally qualified health center or clinic. Again, this will both assist in supporting our federally qualified healthcare centers and community clinics while we try and get more people insured. And then secondly, it also will help control healthcare costs by making sure that the chronic conditions are not advancing. Then we have a Section 19 in the old bill, which provides for the critical access dental providers that are in the healthcare that are in the Minnesota Care program.
That's Section 26 in the gross.
And on this section, we also ask the commissioner to create within the critical access dental program kind of another layer of the program so that there would be a way to get money to nonprofit dental providers with a high proportion of uninsured patients who do not receive a financial benefit comparable to the other critical access dental providers. Again, this is to try to meet the needs of the high number of uninsured people that are being seen in these clinics. Section 20 in the old bill provides that we would have an annual renewal on the enrollment form rather than a biennial renewal. Again, this is to make it easier for people to enroll in the program.
That's in several different sections, 30 for members of the committee, sections 30, 38, 40, 44, 48, and 51. It changes in all of those cases. It goes back to 12 months.
And I'm so glad to see Senator Coring walk into the room.
Hi.
Senator Coring, if you could just come up for a minute to talk about the depreciation provision farmers. For farmers.
That's Section 22 in the engrossed version.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I apologize for being late.
Pardon?
Oh, hi, 22. Senator Berglund, you want me to come up there? Or?
Wherever you feel most
there.
Comfortable
okay.
is fine.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Berglund, I am very proud to be carrying a portion of this bill that is really, really important to me and a lot of my constituents and actually to a lot of our constituents. What happened was this is something that I've been passionate about for, it's going on 5 years now. That goes to show you that around here, if you think things are going to happen quickly, it doesn't happen quickly. You have to be dogged and continue to be after stuff. When I first got here in 2003, I had one of my dairy farmers from my district came to me, and I used to be a dairy farmer for 15 years, so I know what the plight of the dairy farmers. And I had a young man come to me, a single dad with three kids, all under the age of 18 years old, and I believe in 2002 his income, his reported income on his income taxes was about $14,800 and some odd dollars. I think it was something approximately there. And he had about $34,000 worth of depreciation. Now, when you reapply every year, to see if you're eligible for Minnesota Care. What they do is they add back the depreciation, they add it back in and take the $14,000 plus the depreciation, and then automatically he did not qualify for Minnesota Care. And so I had a dad and three kids with no insurance. He went up to Little Falls to see what he could, if he could get insurance, and it was just cost prohibitive for him to get insurance. I think it was something around $1,200 for a very high deductible, and it just doesn't work. And so what I've been trying to do is get rid of the portion that says that they add back the depreciation. So this would help a lot of farmers, not only in my district, but throughout the state, to provide some health care for their family. And I just think it's something that we need to do. And I thank Senator Berglund for actually helping me for the last 4 years to try to get this passed. When we were in deficits, we just couldn't afford to do it. But now I'm hopeful that we're going to get this passed. I support this bill because this is in here. This is extremely important, and I support the component in the bill that we can offer health care insurance to small businesses. This is another plus. And so, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would just stand for any questions if there is any, but just encourage members that this is a very important bill for all of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just correct one thing, Senator Coring. This did not happen over the last 4 years, not because we had a budget deficit, but because we couldn't get the House to agree to it.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I was trying to be polite.
We had the money last session to do this, and we just couldn't get it to happen.
And Mr. Chairman.
And with Senator Coring's help this year, we're going to get it to happen.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just say that Senator Berglund is correct. Everything that I was requesting last year, former Representative Bradley, they took every single thing that I wanted out of the bill. So it was unfortunate. So.
Committee member said the language he's talking about is on page 36, line 13 and 14.
Mr. Chairman and members, we have a provision in the bill, it was old section 23, that eliminates the limited benefit set for adults without children in Minnesota Care. This was a bad idea when it occurred. It was done to reduce some of the expenditures in Minnesota Care in order to transfer money out of the health care access fund into the general fund.
That's section 31 is where it describes that, and the repealer in section 56 is repealing that language, the limited set.
And so the benefits that are being restored are things like physical therapy, dental care, optometry services, things that are not provided directly by a physician but are really critical and essential to one's health care, and oftentimes are provided at a lower cost than what would be provided by a physician. An example is optometric care is provided much less costly than if you were getting the same care from an ophthalmologist. And under this limited benefit set today, you can only get reimbursement for a service if it's provided by a physician. This applies also to certain mental health benefits, which are also being restored in the governor's mental health bill, but we think we need to restore all these benefits, not just the mental health benefits. Then the old Section 25 eliminates the copay for restorative dental services for adults without children. This is part of restoring the benefits set back to what it was before. We have the money now, so we should not worry about this in terms of making sure that the benefits are the same in both parts of the program. Then in the old Section 26, we're eliminating a requirement for all applicants to have Social Security numbers. Because we are also restoring the cut that was made in 2003 where we allowed children who are not citizens to be able to be in our health care programs. In this bill, we're allowing those children to be enrolled in Minnesota Care. I don't see Senator Lynn. She still is in the other room, so I guess I'll skip over this next provision also and come back to it. Section 28, then, is a section that would allow children who are non-citizens to be eligible for Minnesota Care. Section 29 requires the commissioner to award grants to organizations to provide information regarding Minnesota Care programs in areas of the state with high uninsured populations. We have done a number of things in this part of the bill. It would allow for a statewide outreach program. In the thought is that it would be more of an advertising-type program. It would allow grants to organizations that primarily do outreach to our communities of color. Then we also, in this section of the bill, would allow varieties of organizations to be given funding for each application that they turn in that is successfully enrolled in our health care programs. This is true both for medical assistance and the Minnesota Care program. We require certain organizations, including school districts, community clinics, WIC programs, free immunization clinics, Head Start programs, and others that are especially geared toward serving families with children who might be uninsured to make application enrollment forms available and to provide assistance or to refer where a family could receive assistance in filling out the application form.
And that's Section 20. The big outreach program is the long Section 20, and then the places you said where they'd have the forms is Section 37.
Right. I do have just a couple of more author's amendments that I'll offer at the end of the bill, and one of them would apply to this section or would help with enrollment. One of the things we're doing in this bill is to give notice to enrollees and to their health plan prior to their eligibility terminating. And then we're asking the health plans for renewals to contact people if they have not re-enrolled to help them with that process if they need it. An additional thing that the health plans had asked for was rolling eligibility. We used to have rolling eligibility, and it was discontinued in the 2003 session as well. And so the amendment that I have will reinstate the rolling eligibility. That means that a person has a grace month similar to a standard insurance product where they can pay their premium and be reinstated into the program. Section 31, again, is one of the provisions that will help shorten the enrollment form. Section 33 in the old bill will remove the limit. There was a limit in 2003 placed on the Minnesota Care program so that no family that earned over $50,000 a year could be in the program, regardless of their family size. This does affect large families primarily, and this would remove that cap to make sure that those folks can be in the program. Is Senator Olson here yet? We'll get her. The next several sections have to do with her section of the bill. I also am going to be needing Senator Erickson Ropes, if someone can help us locate her. Then in the old Section 38, we eliminate the premium increases that were passed in 2003 and 2005 for the Minnesota Care program. One of the reasons we believe that a number of people have disenrolled from the program is because they can no longer afford their premiums. And the general rule of thumb that we've used in the Minnesota Care Program from the beginning is that premiums should never exceed 8% of income. And, of course, with the premium increases that have been stated in the past, we have done exceeded that. So this would roll back those premiums.
And that's Section 42, I believe, in the new one? Or is that?
That's weird.
If, in other words, if you require the employee to pay more than 8% of their income.
Right. We have a provision in here also because of the phenomenon of the high deductible policies that didn't exist when Minnesota Care was created, so that it's not just going to be a matter of whether the premium you have in your employer's policy is covered by 50% of an employer contribution, but also the deductibles and the other kind of cost sharing, so that if that is more than 8% of an enrollee's income, then the barrier of employer insurance would be removed from that person could come into Minnesota Care. I guess I'm going to call on Senator Lori next to talk about the small employer option. And then I think we're probably going to need to go back to the parts of the bill. Senator Sharon has sent me a note saying that she's going to be tied up presenting her smoking bill for probably the next major part of this committee meeting. So I'll go back and explain those sections for her. And if I could also just call to your attention, in your packet we have a chart from Department of Health report that shows that, again, we're trying to target here a very large percentage of employees in the state work for small businesses who are not insured and the employer doesn't offer insurance. And then we have a handout, which was the best information we had available at the introduction of this bill, about what subsidized premiums and unsubsidized premiums in the Minnesota Care Program look like.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very glad to be here presenting the small employer buy-in option for the Minnesota Care Program. It's something we've talked about the need for a lot in my area of the state, and I know Senator Coring also mentioned the need for programs like this. It's essentially an affordable option for our employers who are trying to attract and retain qualified workforce and treat their employees with the respect and dignity that having a health care plan comes with. I think it's a very important component. Last week in committee, we heard from Jason Stinson some very powerful testimony about one particular employer's challenges in buying and maintaining health care for his employees. The section basically provides an option, again, an affordable option for employers with between 2 and 50 employees. Employees that
Excuse me a second. That's Section 52 for people who are following it in the engrossed version. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Again, for employers with between 2 and 50 employees working a minimum of 20 hours per week, this package would have to be offered to all employees, and the employer would have to certify that at least 75% of the employees were either anticipating signing on or already enrolled in the program. The employer would have to agree to contribute 50% of the premium for families up to 200% without dependents of the federal poverty guidelines, up to 275% for families with dependents. Above that, the employer would have to contribute 100% of the premiums, but would have the option to request that the employee cover the cost of the employee, the dependent, and the spouse for that. The package offered would be the full Minnesota Care package of benefits, and it would have to be offered to the employee, their spouse, and their children. It's a very critical piece of legislation that I believe would help a great number of employers around this state.
And the only other thing I could add, Mr. Chairman, is that this would be a voluntary program. Only employers that were interested in coming into this program would be enrolling in it. We do have in the outreach section also a provision that would allow those that are enrolling people through the small business plan also to get a fee for helping them fill out the application form. And we especially mention insurance agents and chambers of commerce to receive information about the program so that they'd be able to help people sign up.
Does anybody have any idea how many businesses might participate in this? Does anybody track that anywhere?
I have anecdotal evidence, basically, of several businesses in my area that I've talked to that really want to do right by their employees and just simply cannot buy into the current private marketplace for health insurance. And this is, you know, I don't have an actual number. Linda, maybe you have.
I think we'll find out when we get the fiscal note. I think a lot of it depends on the amount of outreach that's done. It varies in various states that have these type of programs.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prittner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, and either Senator Berglund or Senator Laurie, have you been able to assess whether, in fact, employers or employees are able to pay the Minnesota Care premiums? I'm wondering about the Minnesota Care premiums and whether employers and employees who now do not have insurance are able to pay those premiums.
Today that's not available, but under this program it would be.
Yes.
And it would be irregardless of income. So if some of your employees are eligible for Minnesota Care and some of them aren't, then for the ones that aren't, you would be paying full premium, sharing that with your employee. The ones that are eligible, there would be a subsidy.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I've heard some feedback that Minnesota Care premiums are too high for some employees and employers to pay.
Well, of course, if they're under 275% of poverty for families, then we'd be subsidizing them. If they're under 200% of poverty for individuals, we'd be subsidizing them. And if you look at the chart, what we're talking about for a full premium for an individual is $354 a month, approximately, and for a family, $711 a month. So, I mean, that's a pretty reasonable premium, I think, especially when you would be cost-sharing on a 50-50 basis. So for an individual, you'd be talking about a little over $175 a month for the employer and $175 a month for the employee. And we'd be talking about people over 200% of poverty that individual premium would apply to, and for the family premium, we'd be talking about people over 275% of poverty that premium would apply to.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Berglund or Senator Laurie. Just with this particular provision of the bill, and I'm looking at a memo that was sent to the committee from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and they comment about, while they appreciate and favor some of the things in the bill, that some of the provisions they aren't as favorable toward. One of them is the provision that you're talking about, and I'm just wondering what your response to the criticisms that they raise. They're basically saying that Minnesota Care is a product that was designed specifically for low-income people and that it wouldn't necessarily work very well for people of higher or moderate incomes that are working, and that they describe this as essentially saying that it's appropriate to put a cap on inpatient hospital benefits regardless of an employee's income. Then they point out later in the memo that's not a provision that's typically permitted in private health care plans and in fact would tend to drive costs up. So my question is, given the criticism that's being raised by them, what's the response to that to say that we ought to do this?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, first of all, the provision only applies to employers of 50 or less who haven't been able to offer coverage to their employees for at least a year. And so we're basically talking about uninsured people that are, this is another means of reaching those uninsured people. The bill does raise the inpatient cap for people without children to 20,000, which we were told by the Hospital Association only with the cap at 10,000, only 34% of the Minnesota Care patients who have that cap applied exceed the cap. So we felt by raising it to 20,000 that we would probably capture most of those inpatient hospital needs. We think that many of the characteristics of the people in these small businesses are very similar to the people that are enrolled in Minnesota Care today. And so we think it's a way for people to be able to insure their whole group of employees rather than today. Maybe some of them are eligible for Minnesota Care and some of them are not.
And I'd like to,
sure.
If I could.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to echo Senator's comments about the fact that this is really only available for those employers who have not been able to offer health insurance for 12 months. So it is an outreach to an otherwise uncovered population generally. And I did get from Senate Counsel some of the numbers regarding Senator Pretner-Solon's question, and they expect about 10,000 total enrollment in this program. About 637 would be individuals and about 9,300 would be family members, and I think that gives us some idea of the amount of interest and the volume that we're talking about covering here. These are people who are employed in employee situations where the employer cannot buy into the private options that we have available to us today, and so I continue to think it's a very critical option for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. I'm still trying to understand the provision, however, because it would seem to say that a person employed at a smaller company that didn't offer health insurance, and there may be other reasons why they didn't offer it. I don't know. There could be a variety of reasons why they're not offering health insurance, but that the Minnesota Care program would extend to all those employees regardless of their income. And the thing that I'm concerned about in the note I see here is that if you're a higher income person, you may have to be eligible for Medicaid. You may have to do some things to qualify that if you're a higher income may not be easy to do. And so I guess what they're suggesting here in the comment is that Minnesota Care was specifically designed for lower income employees or lower income people. And what we're saying here is that we would offer this plan to people even if they had an income that would otherwise not qualify them for Minnesota Care. Is that correct? What we're doing is we're saying that here's what the income level is, but if you work for a small employer that doesn't have health insurance, then it doesn't matter what your income is. You still would be able to take Minnesota Care.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hand. It does matter what your income is. I mean, if above 200% of federal poverty guidelines for someone without dependents and above 275% of the federal poverty guidelines for somebody with dependents, the state's participation, the state's subsidy of the program disappears. But this would, again, be for employers that were unable to buy into the private insurance market that's available today, and there is some number of people with these somewhat higher incomes. I mean, we're still not talking about upper middle class people here or anything. These are people who are struggling and who find themselves without health care. The state subsidy would go away, but their employer would be required to pay 100% of the maximum Minnesota Care premium for these individuals, but the employer would also be able to go to the employees to require 50% of the cost of the premiums. I don't know if that addresses your question.
Mr. Chairman, just to add one little elaboration, people that would be in this program would not be, if they're above 275% of poverty for a family, would not be applying to be in the medical assistance program. They would just get the benefit of the state's purchasing power to have a policy for those families that A, the state negotiates drug prices, B, the state enters into contracts with health plans so that there are certain things that the health plans have to do for those enrollees, including various disease management programs. So, you know, the one thing that it would be different than a very this is a pretty comprehensive benefit set. The one area that it would be different is that it does not have an unlimited inpatient hospital benefit. But the employer and the employees would know that, and they would be making a decision that this is what they want to do based on the fact that they haven't been able to afford insurance otherwise.
And one follow-up on it. The fact that the cap on the inpatient hospital benefits is a feature of the Minnesota Care, can the private insurers offer that kind of product as well? I mean, if part of the problem is that they can't find this insurance product in the private market, do they have the same kind of product available to sell as Minnesota Care? Can we put a cap on inpatient benefits?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I'm not aware whether they're offering any policies like that, but I do know a couple years ago we passed a provision in the legislature that said that they can design various benefits that are not in compliance with our state laws regarding mandated benefits. So there are policies out there that don't offer maternity benefits. There are policies out there that don't offer mental health benefits, et cetera. We are not talking about doing that in this particular. We're just following what the Minnesota Care Benefits set has been otherwise. And if you didn't do that, then you would have two employees who are working in the same company, one of whom is otherwise eligible for a Minnesota Care subsidy, who would have one benefit, and the other employee working next to them would have a different benefit because they're not eligible for Minnesota Care. So we really had to keep the same benefit set for everybody who would be in the program.
Senator Pettiner-Solan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Berglund, you've already touched on this, and it is along the same lines. And it's hard for me to tell without having it all graphs and the salaries and everything in front of me. My concern is that you're going to find people that are above the 275% of poverty, and they have this limited hospitalization benefit. And are they going to end up then in a catastrophic situation if their hospitalization exceeds is it 10 or 20,000 now? I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, let me clarify. All the families with children do not have the limited hospital benefit. They have the full hospital benefit, probably better hospital benefit than people who have private insurance out there. The only time that the limited hospital benefit applies is to people without children. And as I said earlier, you know, what the Hospital Association told us when we discussed this provision last year is about 34% of their Minnesota Care patients exceed that limit. They felt like most of them would be covered when we raise it to the $20,000 limit.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, on Section E here, it says a non-payment of premiums by a participating employer will result in the disenrollment of all eligible employees effective the end of the month in which the premium was due. Now, are these the employees who are registered with this program need to monitor whether the employer is making those premiums? I mean, is that enough time? If the employer does not make the payment, suddenly they get letters in the mail that they have been disenrolled. How does that affect them? I mean,
I believe that's pretty, Mr. Chair. I believe that's standard language.
Okay.
Right. The payments from the employees, if they're paying a share of it, would be collected by the employer and sent in along with the employer part of the premium.
Okay.
So they're enrolling as a business for their employees. Employers today can drop their private insurance, you know.
Without notification?
Well, yeah. I mean, normally they would be notifying their employees, but there's nothing that requires the policy holder to notify the employees. It would be the employer that would be doing that.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
One other question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the first part, you list, I'm just trying to, for clarification, dependent means an unmarried child who is under the age of 21. And in the first part of this whole bill, we've stated that a dependent is someone who is under the age of 25. How does that work together?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, for the purposes of Minnesota Care today, a dependent is up to age 18. In the bill for the whole program, we're expanding it to 21. And so buying into Minnesota Care, this would be a feature of the program also. So this would not follow the private insurance dependent coverage model. But a person that would be leaving dependent status, if they were eligible to be enrolled in the program, could enroll as an individual in the program to continue their eligibility.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Berglund, there was one little piece that I may have misunderstood that you said a private employer with an insurance policy could drop the policy without their employee knowing?
No, they would be responsible to notify their employees. It would not be the insurer that would be responsible to notify the employee.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, that would be correct. And also, they are under the same kind of plans that we're under, where if they do an open enrollment in a November or October part of the year, they can't just drop a policy. They are contracted for that entire year then also.
We would hope that most employers would be enrolling in this program for a year.
But, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Berglund, I'm talking about just the private insurance that they're buying for their employees, too. They're under the same type of rules, no different than what you are there.
Right.
That if they've contracted for a policy, they have to be on it for a full year. And they probably have to discuss every year when the open enrollment with their employees what they're planning to do.
Yes, they probably would be enrolling for a year, and they probably would be, planning to pay the premiums for the year. But if something happens in the middle of the year and they're not paying their premiums anymore, the bill would give the department the right to cancel the insurance for the employees. I mean, people plan on things, and sometimes they aren't able or don't want to carry out. So the premium's not being collected for a whole year. It's being collected on a monthly basis.
Please proceed then.
Okay. Well, if there are no more questions on this part of the bill, Senator Erickson Ropes is here to talk about her provision, which will allow veterans returning from their obligations to the military to be able to get enrolled in Minnesota Care without a premium for 1 year.
Section 46. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're on page 45 of the large engrossed bill, and if you have a copy of the summary, that would be page 9. This is section 46, subdivision 1, and line C, and I'm happy to bring to you today a provision targeting the military and their families. Upon returning from their tour of active duty, Minnesota veterans or members of the military, if their family or the individual qualifies for Minnesota Care, within 24 months of the end of active duty, would be able to apply for premium coverage to be paid for by the state or through the commissioner's office. And so you will see a short paragraph before you, and I present that to the committee.
Senator Erickson Ropes, with that provision, if somebody is coming back from with some serious psychological issues and so on, is the VA, they're supposed to be covering some of that, but this would kick in where that doesn't? Is that the way it would work?
Mr. Chairman, if they have other coverage through the VA, then they're not eligible for Minnesota Care. But a lot of the people that are in the military now are reservists, and they are not covered by the military policies. So when they come back, then they are eligible for Minnesota Care if they don't have employer coverage offered to them.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, and this would offer an exemption for 12 months of payments through their health care premiums.
Okay, if there's no questions about that section, then I'd like to ask Senator Olson to come to the table. Senator Olson's provisions relate to children and expanding options for children in the Minnesota Care Program.
I believe that's sections 41 to 43.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's sections 34 and 35.
Oh, we have a new engrossment.
Oh, problem. Okay.
So just let Katie figure it out for
okay.
us.
Okay.
So what is it? 41 on page 41.
Page 41 and section 41. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very happy to be here today with Senator Berglund, working with her to present to you what Senate file number 72 and her sections 43 and 44, did you say?
41 through 43.
Okay. Basically, what these provisions do is expand access to Minnesota care to Minnesota's low-income children. As we know, there has been a lot of concern by our constituents and a lot of talk about making health care more available to children in this state, and that's precisely what these sections are designed to do. The first section exempts. Presently, we have an exemption from entitlement to Minnesota care for families who have had access to health care through their employer within 18 months from the time they apply. So they have to wait 18 months after losing health care through their employer before they would have access to Minnesota care. That means that children during this waiting period, whether it certainly is no fault of their own that they're in this situation, it may very well not be any choice that their parents made either, and yet they have to go without needed health care, including preventative care, because of this exemption. So this would eliminate that exemption and allow them to have access to Minnesota care during that 18-month waiting period. The second part of this bill, or part of this section, exempts children who have had access, when their parents have had access to any other type of health care for a period of 4 months. And so basically, if this is the most affordable and best option for them to have access to health care, their parents would have the option to enroll them in Minnesota care, and they wouldn't have to be subject to this four-month waiting period.
And the other major provision is that even if they have employer-sponsored insurance offered to the children, that would no longer be a barrier to coming into Minnesota care. They would have premiums, as Minnesota care does, so you know, people wouldn't probably be dropping their employer insurance to get in here unless that employer insurance is quite expensive for them.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, seems to me the department had a provision last year or maybe the year before similar to this that would allow the children to come into Minnesota care and the families pay a premium. But what we found when we asked the department about their proposal was that they were going to charge the same premium for just the kids that they would have paid for the entire family. How will this work?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, we're reducing the premiums to the pre-2003 level in the bill for families and individuals. So we're reducing the premiums in the program. They would have the same premium they would have had if their children did not have employer insurance offered to them. I don't remember this proposal of the department's because I don't remember anything they've done in the last 4 years to expand access to coverage for anybody. I only remember them cutting it.
I thought it was Minnesota Care. I think we had the discussion, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, in your committee, and we had to dig and dig and dig, but what they finally told us was that they were going to charge the same premium for only part of the family. So at that point, I think we weren't interested anymore.
I don't remember, but, I mean, what we're finding is that, you know, we're reducing the premiums in the bill for individuals in Minnesota Care back to the levels they were before 2003, and we weren't hearing complaints then that the premiums were too much. And so these children would have the same premiums under the bill that families that don't have the offer of employer insurance would have.
Thanks.
We do know that there are people now that are paying 80% of their dependent coverage, but the employer then is paying a higher percentage for the employee coverage. When you put it all together, it's meeting the 50% requirement, but the parents can't afford that 80% for their kids, so they're just not covering their kids. And that's what this is aimed at, to try and make sure those families can come into Minnesota Care.
Can proceed, I guess. No.
Any other questions on this part of the bill? Okay, if not, I think I'm going to go back and get Senator Sharon's provisions. The prescription drug discount program would be Section 19 of the bill. This has been in our bill for quite a number of years, and in fact, in the last biennium, it was in the governor's budget. It would create a way for people up to 300% of poverty, if they do not have a drug program as a part of their insurance, or if they don't have insurance, to get the Medicaid price for their drugs. There would be an enrollment fee to help cover the administrative costs of enrollment. And then after that, they would pay the dispensing fee themselves, but the actual price of the drug would be the Medicaid price. For a lot of people, this will make a difference. It'll help people, especially that have chronic conditions that are where they need quite expensive drugs like multiple sclerosis. And this is a very, very low-cost program for the state. There are one-time startup costs for this only to help finance the program during the time the state's getting the rebates into the treasury for this population.
There are other sections you haven't done
right
yet.
And Senator Lynch, did I forget some of your parts?
Thanks for asking, Senator Berglund.
I'm getting totally confused flipping around here, so why don't you come and present the rest of your provisions?
Go ahead, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund. I appreciate the opportunity. That will teach me for stepping out of the room. I am here to speak to page 38 in your most recent document. And I'm particularly going to call your attention to the provisions in lines 38.15 in that area. And this establishes two things. One, the parameters for the family income are going from 175% of the federal poverty guidelines to 2,000. And you can see Senator Berglund has also amended that further to include 215% after July 1st of 2009.
And that's to make sure that we're anticipating another minimum wage increase. We wanted to make sure that two-person families without children would, if they were both making the minimum wage, would still be eligible.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the other provision in this area has to do with the hospital, the inpatient hospitalization limit that we've heard some discussion on already. And again, that is moving that from 10,000 to 20,000.
So it's 20,000 now. Any questions on that?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prittner-Solin.
Can you please explain to me on page 38, section D, because that appears to me that the $20,000 inpatient cap is placed on families also.
It would be families.
No, this section only applies to people without children.
So, Mr. Chair,
adult enrollees. So that's what they call the part of the program that's for families without children.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, even though it says adult enrollees with family gross income, does it refer to families where only the adult enrollees are not covered, or is it just single adults that are not covered?
It's just adults without children. So you might have a single adult, or you might have a married couple without children.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Solon has the part of the bill that relates to family planning grants, if you want to say a few words about that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, in the last two budget cycles, family planning grants were cut, and moreover, there were further cuts that were supposed to go into effect on July 1st, 2007, that amounted to $1,877,000 for each year of that biennium. So Section 53 eliminates the language that makes the cuts, and Section 55B appropriates $1,156,000 for family planning grants for each year of the biennium beginning July 1st, 2007. This restores the cuts that were made.
And Mr. Chairman, just calling your attention back to the charts a little bit again. We want to remember that in this bill we're trying to target the uninsured. And one of the reasons we're trying to target the uninsured is because that is where our hospital uncompensated care costs come from. And you will see the trend of uncompensated hospital care costs rising dramatically after the 2003 legislative session, going up 25.6% in 2004 and another 28.2% in 2005, so that we're over $215 million a year in hospital uncompensated care costs in this state. These are monies that we all pay. We either pay them through premiums, we pay them through taxes, or we pay them through higher hospital costs when we do go to the hospital and pay the bill ourselves. So we're trying to target a number of these provisions at the source of the uninsured, which on the chart on the front you will see a small amount of that, less than around 18% are children. We do have provisions in the bill to allow more expansion for children into Minnesota care. We need to remember that 80% of the uninsured children today are already eligible for a health care program in Minnesota, so our outreach efforts in the bill are quite robust and need to be robust if we're going to cover the uninsured. You look at the rest of the uninsured, they are adults from age 18 to age 55, to age 64. And we have a number of provisions in the bill, expanding eligibility for adults without children, allowing more outreach, again, to the populations that are already eligible. About a third of these adults are already eligible for a program, one of our health care programs. The small employer plan, little over 10,000 people that will be enrolled in that plan, most of them are families, and they'll be enrolling children and the adult members of the family. So, Mr. Chairman, we're trying to target our efforts to reduce the uninsured. We think we can take it down the road a further than we have already. And then we're asking in this bill the Health Care Access Commission to look at how we can finish getting the uninsured enrolled in an affordable health care program in Minnesota. I do have a few amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't we take them quickly and then get the testimony?
First one is an A27 amendment.
You want to explain it while it's being distributed?
Yes. Remember we talked about last week the emergency room diversion pilot project, and when they saw the language, they thought it did what we wanted it to do, but they really think of it more as a primary care access initiative, trying to find individuals a medical home rather than relying on the emergency room to be their medical home. And so they asked us if we would simply change the language a little bit to change the name of the program and to also indicate that it would be implemented in Hennepin and Ramsey as a web-based primary care access pilot project. So that's what the amendment does.
Is there any discussion? These are still as author's amendments. All those in favor say... Senator Pretner Solon.
Chair, is there a fiscal note attached to this? Would there be?
They're asking for a grant to do this, but the grant is in the hundreds of millions, and the money that they've saved in Wisconsin in doing this project is in the millions.
But so, Mr. Chair, Senator
hundreds
Berglund.
Hundreds of thousands, you mean, for the cost instead of hundreds of millions?
Pardon me? Hundreds of thousands,
okay,
as opposed to
millions.
Millions.
I was thinking a little bit.
Sorry. I thought it right. I just didn't say it right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, sounds like a very good idea. And why would we not want to do it all over the state rather than just Hennepin and Ramsey County?
Well, that's where we're starting because that's where we have more emergency rooms being used by a higher volume of people. And they just can't do the whole state at one time. They have to hire people to come in, and they have to get agreements from the hospitals who have emergency rooms to allow their employees to be in the emergency rooms discussing a diversion with the patients that are in the emergency room waiting.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the idea is to meet the patient at the door of the emergency room to determine if they could be seen in primary care rather than in the emergency room?
While they're waiting, there are people in this project that would talk to them about what they're there for and if they feel they could be seen in a doctor's office, if they'd like to be seen in a doctor's office, and then they have this computerized system where they find vacancies that are available in the clinics that day or the next day for the patient to be seen in a primary care setting. And it involves dental also, so because we have a lot of emergency room use for dental pain, they also work with dental offices to schedule dental appointments.
So, Mr. Chair, I think this is an excellent idea. I think I might actually recommend it to my community because we already have the setup where they would be able to do that, and it seems like a good idea.
Oof. Further discussion on the A27 amendment. If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. You had one more author's amendment?
A24
amendment. While it's being distributed, maybe you can.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I mentioned last week that there was an amendment requested by the Department of Employee Relations that we didn't have time to draft. Well, now we've had time to draft it. It would exempt the public employees' insurance program from the premium caps that are outlined in the bill. The rest of the amendment deals with the issue that I talked about just a few minutes ago, reinstating the rolling eligibility for premiums in the Minnesota Care Program.
Is there any discussion of this amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, then I'd just like to call to your attention. We had a lot of people that didn't testify last week. We asked them to hand out letters, and so we have letters.
And we also have several who do wish to testify. Senator Coring, do you want to wait until after their testimony for your amendment?
Well, I guess I'd like to go forward with it now, if that'd be okay with you.
No idea.
If it's, I don't care. I mean, if you want to pursue it now, that's fine. Unless you think the testimony will relate to it. Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, I just, before we take testimony, maybe other amendments, I had one question that during the course of the presentation, could I ask the question? And
please go ahead.
And I don't know in the engrossment what
Mr.
section.
Mr. Chairman, if you could just ask the people in the audience to be quiet. I can't hear Senator Hahn. Thank you.
I'll try to speak louder, Mr. Chairman, but thank you. And I don't know in the engrossment which the section is, because I think, Senator Berglund, when you were going through the bill, you were referring to the original bill. And in the original bill that we got last week, this was section 31, which is on page 33 and then into 34 of the document. And when you were talking about it, you were going through and saying that you're trying to do some things to make the application process easier and to shorten that process. And
mm-hmm.
And the part that you're striking, I'm not sure if I understand this, because it seems as if what we're saying is that even though this program is dependent on eligibility criteria with respect to income, and that now we're saying that the commissioner doesn't have to verify income in order to accept people into the program. I'm sorry?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hunt, you're not interpreting this section correctly. They would still be verifying income. The individual has to turn in pay stubs to show their income. This is a section that relates to an applicant having to submit the names of their employers, contact names, and telephone numbers for each employer. And it's to verify whether they have employer coverage that would meet the employer coverage definition. And what's happening with the program is that some of these folks have several employers, and one of the barriers to getting their enrollment form done is they don't have all of this information for every employer.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I can understand that the intent is to try to take care of a problem that might be out there, but the language that's stricken says that in determining eligibility, the commissioner shall require applicants and enrollees seeking renewal to verify both earned and unearned income. And that is being stricken. So the law no longer requires the commissioner to verify earned and unearned income, as it reads. And that's the part I'm concerned about. I could appreciate the fact that you're wanting to say, let's find a way to provide information about your employer in a way, maybe there's some things to modify that. But to strike the whole requirement that says the commissioner has to verify eligibility based on income.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, the program has always had income guidelines, and people who are applying have always had to verify had to show their income stubs.
No.
This is a provision that goes above and beyond that, then, to require that the employer also provide that information. It's kind of onerous for the employer. It's kind of a violation of people's privacy rights. They have to go to their employer and ask them to do all this stuff for their application form. And since this is the only reason you would go to an employer to get all of this, the employer pretty much knows you're applying for Minnesota Care. So there are still ways in the program, and this does not deny the department the right to, on a random basis, call employers and verify through that mechanism. What it does take away is the applicant having to gather all this stuff up and bring it along with their application. We never had this in the program before last year, and it has become one of the more onerous parts of the application form for many applicants, and we've always had the income requirements in the bill. In the law, I mean.
That's section 39. Senator Coring.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I have the A26 amendment, and I believe it's been handed out. What this is, Mr. Chairman, is over the past several years, the state has been required to pay for abortions here in Minnesota, and what this is doing is saying that the state of Minnesota will no longer be paying for abortions. MCCL has reported that I think the taxpayers have spent $8 million in the last several years to pay for abortions, and so this would stop that from happening. And so I would offer this again, the A26 amendment, and stand for any questions. And ask, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for a roll call vote on this.
Sure. On the A26 amendment, Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this amendment really goes beyond the scope of this bill, Senator Coring. First of all, you need to understand that the Minnesota Care Program doesn't pay for abortions. I'll say that again. The Minnesota Care Program doesn't pay for abortions. That is not part of the benefit set. The family planning grants that we give out in the state of Minnesota do not pay for abortions. That's already in the law. So the program that pays for abortions is a medical assistance program. There have been lawsuits, and the lawsuits have said that if you provide maternity benefits in your Medicaid program, then you must provide abortion services as well. You can't discriminate based on the type of benefit you mm-hmm. give to a pregnant woman. Your amendment is getting to that basic part of the Medicaid program, which really isn't part of this bill. I mean, you have to admit that. We're not trying to change what benefits we provide in the medical assistance program as a part of this bill. So your amendment kind of goes beyond the scope of the bill. But I expect this won't be the first or the last time we see an amendment like this. So my recommendation would be that we just vote the amendment down. The intent of the amendment, the goal of the amendment, is to challenge again the provision of abortion benefits as a part of the Medicaid program, which has already been challenged and gone through the court process in the state of Minnesota before. And they'd like to see if they could challenge it again and have another ruling on it. And so we have this amendment, which in the meantime could interrupt that benefit in the Medicaid program. Again, not really the focus of Senate File 2 here today. So, Mr. Chairman, my recommendation to the members of the committee would be that we defeat this amendment. This would not be helpful, Senator Coring. I realize you're trying to be helpful with Senate File 2 here, but this would not be a helpful addition to the bill at this time.
Further discussion of the A26 amendment. Senator Coring requested a roll call.
Mr. Chairman, I would just ask, a voice vote would be sufficient.
Okay. We'll withdraw the request for roll call. No further discussion. If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Senator Bergen, why don't we take the witnesses now and then more amendments and more discussion after that. Why don't we start with Julie Brunner. Welcome to the committee. And we have a letter in the packets from you, I believe.
We do. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Brunner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. There was a February 7th letter in your packet. I want to just touch briefly on a couple points from the letter. And actually, you've had quite a bit of discussion on a couple of the things that I want to emphasize today already in the committee hearing. The Council of Health Plans supports language in Senate File 2 to increase eligibility for government health care programs and reduce barriers to health care access. These efforts go a long way to provide coverage for many uninsured in Minnesota. We particularly support coverage of as many children as possible, exempting children from the ESI rule and the 4-month waiting period, decreasing the length of the Minnesota Care application from its current 24 pages, allowing annual renewal across all Minnesota health care programs, and eliminating co-pays for many of the programs. All of these measures not only ensure greater access to health care, but also minimize paperwork and administrative efforts needed to routinely disenroll and re-enroll families in these programs. We also support the increase in the hospital benefit under Minnesota Care from $10,000 to $20,000. My understanding is that the $20,000 cap does not apply to children, but does apply to adults in Minnesota Care.
No, adults without children.
Adults without children.
Right. Doesn't apply to families at all.
So if you are, excuse me, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, so a family with two children would not have the $20,000 cap?
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Bruner, that's correct. The cap only applies to individuals without children today, and we're raising it over what it is today for that group of people. And the fiscal note we've had in the past on the small employer plan, of the over 10,000 that would be enrolled, fewer than 600 would fall into this category.
Finally, we support, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, thank you for that clarification. Finally, we also support the language to expand and improve outreach so that more people who are eligible can be enrolled in the program. According to Department of Health data, 78% of uninsured children are eligible for existing programs. Making it easier to reach these children and enroll them will bring Minnesota closer to the goal of universal coverage. We do have some concerns about sections of the bill, and I want to emphasize two of those. We oppose the language that places artificial caps on health care premiums. Health care plans recognize that the rate of premium increase is reaching a breaking point for individuals and employers, and it needs to be addressed. However, placing arbitrary caps on premiums does not address the system's health care cost drivers, such as new technologies, increasing utilization, an aging demographic, and aggressive provider negotiations. I also am surprised and question somewhat the rationale for exempting Doer from the premium cap as well, and I think that was the amendment that the committee adopted a few minutes ago. Health plan premiums are increasing because the cost of health care is increasing. In reality, there are four basic options for slowing the trends in health care spending: increasing the efficiency of health care, increasing incentives so that patients limit inappropriate use of health care or medical services, increasing administrative controls on the use of health care services, and limiting resources available to the health care system. Minnesota is obviously not alone in facing this problem, and systems throughout the country and probably throughout the world are pursuing variations on trying to solve this using all four options in one way or another. But success for this is not coming easily anywhere. One of our greatest challenges is overcoming the current economic models in the healthcare system that reward providers based on how many procedures are performed, not on the outcomes that are received. There are a number of efforts underway by payers, both government and private, as well as providers that are attempting to reverse this. But the current model is very well established, and as we know, change does not come quickly in this area. As a state and as a nation, we must face the inherent trade-offs between health care costs and people's access to care. People want access to care when they want the care. Until we do, the cost of care will continue to increase, as will the corresponding premiums. Our other major concern with the bill is section, and I'm not sure what section it is in the engrossed version, allowing small employers purchase coverage for employees through Minnesota Care. Health plans proudly serve Minnesotans enrolled in Minnesota Care. We realize that on the face of it, this legislation seems like a good idea because it will cover or could cover more people. And because the plans serve Minnesota Care, this could potentially represent more members for the health plans as well. However, as noted in my letter, the product was not designed for the small group market. It was designed for low-income individuals. We don't think this would be a good product for people whose incomes are above the level currently required in Minnesota Care. The Minnesota Care benefit would provide less comprehensive coverage than products offered in the small group market. This will also compound the problem of uncompensated care for hospitals, in our opinion, putting even greater strain on hospitals to recoup their uncompensated care losses through cost shifting to the private commercial market. When comparing the full premium cost of Minnesota Care to other existing commercial products, we believe the product proposal does not provide small employers with the financial relief it promises. We've seen some of these statistics and numbers that were distributed this morning, and we have some questions about them, which we will study and discuss with Senator Berglund. There are already similar products in the commercial market with better coverage that are similarly priced to the full premium Minnesota Care product. All of these concerns underscore the point that this product wasn't really designed for the full population. If a hospitalization cap were the right way to lower costs for small employers, then the legislature probably would have authorized this option already in the private market, and you haven't. We appreciate how important these healthcare policy issues are. However, we believe a more appropriate public policy discussion should be about what essential appropriate benefits should cover. We would like to see the legislature work with the private market to identify opportunities through unique plan design and cost reductions to make healthcare more affordable for the small group market, because we do understand that this is a major problem for small employers in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Bruner. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Mayor Berglund.
Just one other comment about the small employer plan. What we envision is that most of the employers that are going to want to buy into it are going to have some employees who would be subsidized and some employees who would not. And so then that makes their premium kind of in between the two examples that we gave. And so we think for a number of employers it will make a difference as to whether they feel they can buy into the product or not.
And Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Senator Hand.
Can I ask one question just to clarify? And I was reading your letter earlier, I guess, and I just want to clarify. My impression was that you were saying that currently private markets cannot put a cap on inpatient benefits. In other words, that the private market couldn't come up with a policy that put a $20,000 cap on hospital benefits, and that's one of the differences that is being offered through Minnesota Care, and that potentially if a private insurer were able to do that, that the rates might be very competitive with what Minnesota Care offers today. Is that the correct way to interpret your letter?
Senator Marty and Senator Hahn, you are correct. At this point, health plans are not permitted to put out a product with that kind of a limit. We're not authorized to do it. We cannot have that kind of a limit for inpatient hospital costs.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, and maybe Senator Berglund, if that's the case, maybe the best way to do this would be to allow private insurers to offer this kind of product and see if there's some benefit to the small businesses. I understand your point that there are concerns about how to provide insurance opportunities to small business, but it seems to me a little odd to have this program do something that the private markets aren't even permitted to do and say that's the solution to not having that being offered in the private market.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, again, we're talking about a part of the small employer market that has given up. They are not offering coverage. We are offering them this opportunity to bring them back to the table. And again, to be a partner in helping us to finance health care for the uninsured. We think many of them would like to do that. I think that's a wholly and entirely different conversation than talking about offering a general insurance product that would have a hospital cap of $20,000 on it. Again, what the numbers we see, the people that would be affected by this in this type of offer would be small compared to the people who would not have that limited benefit. And we think that it's an important outreach program to get more people enrolled who today do not have health insurance. So I can understand where people might disagree with that, but we today have a lot of limitations on our public programs. This is one where we feel that we are raising it enough so that we will avoid most of the uncompensated care problems that would be created by the product. Understand, if a person who is working for one of these small businesses today that doesn't have insurance at all is hospitalized, they're probably not going to pay $20,000 worth of the hospital bill that they get. So under this program, they'll be paying it, and if there's something besides that, then maybe they can help pay some of that. But today, they're probably not going to pay much of a $20,000 hospital bill.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question may have already been asked. I might have been out of the room. But what's going to prevent an employer from dropping his insurance knowing that this option's out there?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, that's why we say you can't be in this program unless you've not been able to offer coverage for 12 months. That's the insurance barrier that we've used that in our state programs. That's the insurance barrier that most other states that have similar programs use.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Berglund, 12 months is a really short period of time to eventually get on the program.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, we're going from one extreme to another here. We've just talked about how people wouldn't want this insurance because it's not good enough, and now we're talking about people dropping what they have to get onto this. I don't think most people would be dropping their coverage unless they really can't afford that coverage to start with, and they were probably going to drop it anyway.
Senator Lori.
Just
they still have to pay a premium to be in this program. You know, it's not like they're going to get it free.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to add 12 months is a very long time without insurance coverage. I mean, and so if somebody were to drop it and have to wait the 12 months, it would be quite a burden on their employees.
Ms. Bruner, thank you very much. Next, we have Beth Hartwig, and I'll call Aaron Sexton next then. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Erin Sexton. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I want to start by pointing out a few things that we really like in this bill, and there are a number of them, and Beth and I will both talk about those, but one of which is the patient incentive program. I think it's a good step to take to make patients and consumers accountable for the healthcare reform that needs to occur in our system. We all share a role in reforming healthcare, and that includes those of us who consume healthcare services and need to take a little responsibility for some of our own healthcare also. So we do support setting some goals and providers helping live up to those goals and providing some incentives to do that. So I think that that's a good step. I just briefly want to touch on a couple other things, and I'll turn it over to Beth. But one is the Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access, too. I think from our perspective, a healthcare reform is a three-legged stool, and that includes access, cost, and quality. And if we're going to set up a commission to look at healthcare, we should look at setting up a commission that addresses all three of those aspects. So not just access, but add in cost and quality also. We think all three of these need to be addressed at the same time. We can't just address one without talking about the others. And then the last thing I'll just briefly talk about is the Minnesota Care for Small Employers. The Chamber has supported looking at a number of other private market options to help small employers purchase health insurance for their employees. We do have some concerns with looking to a public program versus private market options. And I guess from our perspective, we would urge you, whether you choose to move forward with this or not, but to not give up at looking at private market options for employers. I think that's an option they would prefer. I think it's an option we can help out with here also. And I think there's other ideas on the table, and I would point to the governor's health exchange as one potential option in the private market that I think employers that would be helpful to employers. And you know, I would throw out just one example, and I did this sort of for my own little exercise more than anything. But I was just curious, you know, after looking at Senator Berglund's numbers in I think it was the press conference they did a while ago, and that a full premium in the Minnesota Care Program would be about $711 for a family of three. So I just went on. I put in my own family. I have a husband who's, you know, pushing 40, and we have two little kids. And so I put in my family's information and basically found a high-deductible plan that was about $400 a month for premium, which is about $3,000 cheaper than the Minnesota Care estimated premium. And then it had a $3,600 deductible, so I took that 300 times 12, which amazingly added up to about $3,600. So I think, and that option also has the option for a health savings account, so I could take that $3,600. It would be pre-tax, and there are some benefits. And then you look at something like the governor's health exchange, and then you're also purchasing the premium pre-tax. So I think there are other options out there to look at, and I appreciate Senator Berglund putting this forward as one option, but I would also encourage you to continue to look at private market options in addition to this, because I think that's what employers really want, and that's what we've heard. So with that, I'll turn it over to Beth.
Beth, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Hartwig, and I represent Minnesota Business Partnership. Aaron and I are doing this together because we had a lot of the same points, so I'm on the same page as her on the points that she just made. I'll just touch on a couple additional proposals within Senator Berglund's bill. We do really appreciate the efforts that Senator Berglund has continued to make on pushing health care reform. One of the really positive parts we see in this bill is the health information and technology goal setting that she has within here. The chamber and the partnership, along with a number of other organizations, including the state as a purchaser of employee as well as public health benefits, are members of the Smart Buy Alliance. And the Smart Buy Alliance has had a goal of statewide interoperability by 2012. So we've actually been a little bit more aggressive than the senator in that. Technology is not the barrier for achieving interoperability and electronic medical records. They could do that next week if we gave them the standard. So we have to identify what those standards are. One point of clarification, and I apologize I haven't had an opportunity to speak with Senator Berglund about this, is there may need to be some clarification within the language of the bill that says it's interoperable across systems. So, for example, I may get some of my care at an Alina clinic and some of my care, especially care, at a Fairview clinic. I want to be sure that the records are interoperable between those systems, just not within, and there may need to be some clarification in the way the language reads right now. The second thing that we're really supportive of is administrative simplification, and she's identified some very specific ways of getting at that through uniform billing. The last point that I would make is, unfortunately, an opposition to the premium caps. For the same reasons that Ms. Bruner just stated, we think that premium caps are an artificial constraint on health care premiums. Health care insurance is expensive because health care is expensive. And unless we get at the drivers of health care costs, we're not going to slow down that growth, and it's just going to be shifted to someone else. And it would, you know, in this scenario as it's written, there is a possibility of shifting to other sectors with the premium caps. With that, I'd end my comments, and we'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Questions from the committee for either of us. Senator Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, of the two groups that you represent, how many, or would you say as far as a percentage even, are self-insured?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, 100% of my members are self-insured.
Mr. Chairman, not mine. We represent about 80% of our membership is smaller businesses, and most of those do not self-insure. So we have a significant portion of our membership who is not self-insured.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, Ms. Hartwig, the 100% that you have, is there a particular reason why they're self-insured as opposed to going through the marketplace to get their insurance?
I think there's, Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, there's probably a number of reasons. They are under ERISA protection. They do not have to follow state regulations. There are large groups that are able to assume the risk that smaller groups in the fully insured market are not able to. They are able to provide the benefit set and so forth that they would want to, among many others. I'm sure there are a number of reasons why they choose to be self-insured.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Senator Money. Ms. Hartwig, I need to understand the cap thing again and how the caps are going to dissipate the dollars to the private insurer. Is that how you're saying it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, the premium caps, because the state is not able to regulate the self-insured market, and as I believe an amendment that was made today excludes PEEP from the premium caps as well, the insurance rates of those organizations who do not fall under the state regulation could see a cost shifting.
And Mr. Chairman, and that goes to kind of the statement I was trying to make earlier. We might see less and less private insurers because of that, because they won't be able to afford the premiums as it gets spread to them.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that could be a possibility. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. It sounds like universal care through the back door.
Senator Berglin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee and Ms. Hartwig, when we had the premium caps in the 1990s, they applied to all insurance products. Self-insured employers were not exempted, and it's not the intention in my bill that they be exempted. The only reason that we've exempted the Department of Employee Relations is because for some reason, they seem to think that having these caps will raise their costs. I don't agree with them about that, but I'm not going to fight with them about it. You know, if it does not, if they get cost shifted onto, they'll be back in a nanosecond to get included in the bill again. So, but otherwise, it applies to everybody, and the idea here is to impose some discipline on the system. I'm sure you would be one of the first people to agree that we have too many imaging machines in the state of Minnesota, and we're paying for each and every one of them. And I'll give the health plans credit that they're trying through the managed care portion to do something about it with a lot of pushback. You know, it is the kind of tool that we have in this bill that's going to get people to the table to say, okay, let's figure out what we're doing that we really don't need to do. Let's get the waste out of the system. And it's the provision that's in the bill is going to guarantee that payers like your employers, when we do build in administrative savings like we've done in Senate File 2, that you actually see something come back to you out of that. There are so many people in the healthcare system who make a lot of money on it, ready to gobble up more money the minute you get a savings in the system. I've been working on trying to get savings in the system for a long time. And it's really hard to ever see that benefit a payer. I would like to see the savings we have in this bill benefit the payers.
Ms. Hartwig.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglin, and I need to address the rest of the committee specifically on that point, then I would need to add an additional opposition to the partnership's position on this bill. The ERISA, I'm not an ERISA attorney. I'm not an attorney at all, but my understanding of the language as it is in the bill, that it wouldn't address self-insureds, and if your intention would be that it does include self-insureds, we would strongly oppose that. The intention and the purpose of ERISA protection for self-insured companies is that companies that we represent that have maybe situated, maybe headquartered here in Minnesota, or may not for that matter, but any company that has employees in multiple states, the intention of ERISA was to protect them from state-by-state regulation, which would, in essence, increase the administrative burden on those self-insured companies and increase the cost of the insurance to their employees. That is the intent of ERISA, is to protect multi-state companies from state-by-state regulation, and we would very strongly oppose that. And I would imagine that the state would likely find itself in a ERISA battle if they were to implement that.
Thank you. Further questions? If not, call on Bob Vanosik. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Vanosik, and I'm here representing the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. We applaud the stated goal in Senate File 2 that all Minnesota residents should have access to affordable health care by January 1st, 2010. This bill, as well as many others that have been introduced thus far this session, have demonstrated that the legislature has once again made health care coverage a priority issue. We haven't seen this level of interest since Senator Berglund and others led the effort to enact Minnesota Care back in 1992. However, we do have serious concerns with Section 19 of the bill that establishes a new prescription drug discount program. We question the need to establish a complicated new drug program when the legislature is, in fact, moving toward affordable health care for all Minnesotans. Instead, we would point out that there is an existing partnership for a prescription assistance program. It's a clearinghouse that offers a single point of access to more than 150 free and discounted programs that are offered by the pharmaceutical industry. It includes more than 2,500 brand-name prescription medicines, and in Minnesota, this program has already served nearly 30,000 Minnesotans. Many of these patients are getting their drugs free or at a discount that is greater than what would be envisioned if this new program that's proposed under Section 19 were enacted. The programs that are offered under the prescription for the Partnership for Prescription Assistance are designed to be programs of last resort. So it's possible you could end up with situations where individuals that are currently receiving free prescriptions may end up having to pay some amount if the new program is enacted. So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I just want to once again commend Senator Berglund and this committee for your efforts to make health care coverage more accessible and affordable for Minnesotans.
Thank you. Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing Life Science Alley. Many of you may be familiar with our trade association. It is formerly known as Medical Alley. We merged with MinBio last year, but on behalf of our over 500 members, I would just echo the testimony that Mr. Vanosik just gave on behalf of pharma. We do include in our membership a number of pharmaceutical companies, and we believe that price controls fail to target those most in need of prescription drugs and reduce the funding necessary for research. The solutions to access to prescription drugs is through expanded insurance coverage, and Senator Berglund and the committee should be congratulated for those efforts. Mr. Chairman, if there are further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Questions for either of the witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Twyla Braze and John Tyler are the last two I have listed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare, and we are a free market healthcare policy organization. And we support patient and doctor freedom, medical entrepreneurship, and medical innovation, and the confidential private patient-doctor relationship. Gives you an idea who we are. As Senator Berglund said on Thursday, and has said again today, Senate File 2 is meant to expand government programs and mandate government to establish a universal coverage system. But such expansion of government health care programs often leads to the expansion of government power in medical decision making. As an example of the growth of that kind of power, the bill would institute premium caps, expenditure and expenditure limits, thus limiting the amount of money that's spent on health care services. And anytime you limit the money amount, you limit the services. In addition, consider that the 2005 Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill authorized the Department of Human Services to hire a medical director and gave that medical director the right to define evidence-based medicine and the power to deny Medicaid and Minnesota Care patients even the right of an appeal based on the director's definition of that term. Evidence-based medicine, according to renowned Princeton health economists, is the sine qua non of managed care, the whole foundation of it. So together, premium caps, spending limits, and the director's power to direct medical decisions and deny care to patients will lead to rationing of care. The 2005 provision was added for cost containment purposes 2 years ago, yet now this bill proposes to grow these programs, potentially leading more people to enroll in Medicaid in Minnesota care and leaving more people vulnerable to coverage without care. Instead, our organization would like to see policies that would open up the medical insurance market here in Minnesota to increase competition. We'd like to see insurance become real insurance rather than prepaid healthcare policies, which are expensive and lose a lot of money in administrative costs, because every bill has to move through a third-party payer. Even the smallest of bills has to have paperwork attached to it. So let me make three specific, or talk about three specific concerns about the enrollment provisions. And I think I've got the pages right now. But on pages 37 and 38, the increase from 10,000 to 20,000 is essentially what I would consider a bigger hook to get more people onto a program that's not insurance. As it's been talked about here, and as even Senator Solon talked about, you know, more people could get involved in, or get to find themselves in a spot where they don't have coverage when they have a catastrophe, and what will that mean for them? So it's better to offer them real insurance than a product that's not insurance. Page 20, line 9, talks about the outreach efforts. And I just like to say that given the fact that government programs already don't pay providers enough or sufficiently for health care services, the fact that you're going to try and get more people into this program is a concern, and it means more cost shifting. We ask you to be mindful of the findings of the health department in their 2002 report on the uninsured, where they said, they talked about the poor uptake in welfare or in Minnesota care and Medicaid, and they said there's not as much stigma concerning Minnesota care, but people still see MA as welfare. Anything that can be considered county assistance or is registered by the county through the Health and Human Services is associated with welfare. It is a pride issue. People just don't want to go on welfare, end quote. Now, if you move to page 47, line 23, the enrollment section of the Minnesota Care Option for Small Employers. And our concern about this, we've concerned about expanding Minnesota care no matter what, but could this portion not be the beginning of a long line of categories for whom the income and asset limits of Minnesota care are not applied in the future? I think we're just opening up the program for broad expansion and we'll set a precedent here. The last thing I'm going to talk about are the sections having to do with access to patient data. And if you'll go to page 21, line 21, that's the uniform billing forms and coding requirements. And I think that that sounds good on its face. People sort of like that idea. But you have to understand that it sets up Minnesota to be part of a national healthcare system and a national health information system. And you have to also realize that only treatments that have an approved code will be considered care, and only treatments that have a code will be paid for. And that means that it can become a very political piece for exactly what's going to get a code and what isn't, and therefore what kind of care will be available and what will not. And then it, page 11, 30, line 31, the Health Information Technology and Infrastructure section, this is an unfunded mandate. According to an article in Health Affairs, the cost of setting up such a system is $44,000 per physician and $8,500 to maintain it. The interoperable system will be statewide for the purpose of sharing and synchronizing patient data across systems. It must be compatible with federal efforts to create a national health data system. And notice there's nothing in there that talks about patient privacy, patient control of the data, not letting the data go so from Dr. A to Dr. B, because you don't actually want Dr. B to hear what Dr. A said about you, and you don't even believe it's true. So, you know, to be really direct, an interoperable, statewide, synchronized system means that the patients will have nowhere to hide. It means that their privacy will never be protected. It means that whatever one doctor says, another doctor will hear. It means that every prescription that they have every diagnosis that they have will be available, and not just to the health plans, but to the health department. So this is setting up a huge system to take the patient's data, and when you move to the part on page 13, line 31, where it talks about reporting and creating report cards, essentially, that's what this is creating and tapping into all this data and making these report cards, and this will be attached to pay for performance, and doctors will be paid according to how they perform. The data will essentially be and can be used against patients, and it's completely out of their hands. So I want to just remind you that in New York, a study came out and showed that the New York reporting system found that, unlike it had been originally reported, it was not that the report cards decreased mortality and morbidity, but instead that the report cards kept doctors from taking the riskiest patients, and some patients had to go outside the state of New York in order to receive care, because the doctors started treating to their scores, being worried about medical malpractice, how they looked, et cetera. So I think what I wish to leave you with is to say that personal medical decisions are too important to be left to other people to decide how the practice of medicine should be run. And it's too important to have access to the kind of health care that you need to have other people making limits on your spending, what you can pay for premiums, and sort of cutting off your options. So I hope that you'll take these comments into consideration as you're making your decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. Questions from Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of comments. The first one is that we already have QCare. The governor's QCare exists. What this bill does is give a reward to the public patient who is not smoking or following whatever one of the guidelines are regarding, you know, diabetes and heart disease. And it just seemed to me that if we were giving the provider a reward, certainly the patient has to be part of that equation, and getting more patients involved and wanting to be compliant with those standards would be important. So the bill doesn't deal with all of the governor's QCare. That's already in law, and some of it, at least, is part of the budget. The second thing is that the bill doesn't change the medical data privacy laws at all. All it does is set up a goal in the future for all of the electronic records we have today to be interoperable, and for all of our healthcare systems to get onto electronic medical records. So whatever the laws are that restrict a patient's data being transferred to some other provider without their permission, all of those laws still would be in effect.
Ms. Bray.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, first of all, I realize that QCare is in effect as an executive order, but not actually as law, and I guess you could contend whether one or the other. But I think it's of great concern that you now even start to look at going into the patient's life, lifestyle, medical history, wherever, to start trying to find out whether or not they comply with the behavior or the lifestyle that you're looking for, rather than giving them reasons of their own, which is to spend their own money, which makes a difference as to what they're going to have to pay in the end. So I think, you know, I think it's a bad idea when government starts looking that deep into someone's life and what they do and trying to monitor and whether they can get paid or an incentive or not. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing has to do with what you said about the how this is not dealing with the privacy law at all. And it's not quite dealing with it, but it does say that it has to align with federal efforts. And this could be easily an amendment. I could see an amendment in the future, which has been proposed in the last 2 years, of conforming to HIPAA. And HIPAA, perhaps you do or do not know, is not really a privacy rule at all, because there's no patient consent in it at all. And so I think when you're talking about synchronizing all the patient data, the people who would look at this law would have to contend with your language about synchronizing and other language that has to do with the privacy of medical records. And there would be a conflict.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure, maybe Senator Berglund is the person to direct the comment or question to for a response. When I think of interoperable medical records, as much as I value data privacy, I think that's a good thing, but and I want to be clear if I'm understanding it correctly. The thing I always think of with interoperable electronic is if, for instance, I'm in a car accident away from my home clinic and I wind up in an emergency room in southern Minnesota, I'd kind of like the doctor that's going to work on me to know my history. And if I understand it right, that's what interoperable electronic records would do. And I kind of want them to know what medications I'm on before they treat me or give me something different that would contradict what I'm already doing with my current doctor. Is that a correct summation of what it does?
Sir Berger.
Chairman and Senator Wergen, yes, that's the idea behind this. You know, and in greater Minnesota, there are a lot of times when people need to go to a specialist that's not in their home community. And now, you know, if their home clinic knows they're going to that specialist, we actually have to transport that paper record to the next place. And so there's a lot of money going into schlepping these records around. I guess one could question whether a paper record is more confidential than an electronic record. I mean, the records, when they're paper, whoever's taking that record to the next place, you know, has possession of the record. With an electronic system, of course, not only do you have access to what's in the paper, but oftentimes electronic records now can actually even show you X-ray images or, you know, other types of parts of the medical record that wouldn't be on paper. So the whole intent is not to violate anybody's data privacy, but to reduce administrative costs and to increase the quality of care by having all the providers that are serving you have better information about your records.
Senator Erickson-Robeson, I would like to keep moving because the chair really hopes we can get this bill done, and I don't know how many amendments there are left. So go ahead, Senator Erickson-Robeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Berglund. And I've talked to Senator Berglund just briefly about some of my concerns about the electronic medical records in the past, but I do just want to echo some of the concerns in that I think this is one of those situations where it's an and situation. It is true that the efficiency for administration would be greatly improved. And it's true, like Senator Wergen outlined, that your medical history would be just at the fingertips of any physician in the United States, really, if we want to extend it that far. And these are good things. And yet, there does exist a potential for huge amount of either potential violations or identity theft. And I do speak from some sort of experience in the past, since I was one of those veterans who had my identity stolen earlier in the year. You remember the big scandal out in Washington, D.C., where they lost, you know, hundreds of thousands of veterans' information. Anytime you digitize information and you put it out there, in the cyber world, there is a capacity for theft or hacking into a system. So I just want to put a concern out there that, and I'm not speaking one way or another, but this has to be something that we all have discussions about, I think continued discussions as we move forward.
Thank you. Further discussion on this issue? If not, Ms. Braze, quickly and then go ahead.
Yes, quickly. Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, to address what you have talked about, would it not be something that you might be interested in instead to have your own flash key, perhaps, that had the information that an emergency room physician would need? Having worked in the emergency room for many years before I was here, I know that there's actually very little information that we need in the emergency room, and much of what we deal with is what you look like and how you're acting. And if you had only your diagnoses and your medications on your keychain, what our concern is that what we will do here is create a system where every physician's decision is tracked, scored, and paid accordingly, and this can become very political, and rationing of care can happen, and complete profiles on someone can be created. So we are trying to build the patient's control over their medical information. We're not saying you can't have electronic medical records if you want them, but you shouldn't be forced into having them, and then if you have them, you should have the control.
Senator Higgins, briefly.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Braze, I think the College of St. Scholastica students all have their medical records on a flash drive. But let me tell you, they're just as easily left someplace, stolen, you know, corrupted as lots of other things. And I will just bring up my idea that nobody likes except me, but someday we will all be microchipped, just like our dogs. And then our information will all be there. And you all can kind of groan at me, but someay it'll happen.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a quick response. I realize that there's good and bad to it, but the, for instance, that I would give you, I have a sister that's on kidney dialysis, and let me tell you, it wouldn't take much of a mistake in an emergency room if someone didn't know she was on dialysis to kill her.
Thank you very much. Discussion from the committee, amendments from the committee. This is Mr. Tyler?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. I have some packets to pass out.
We will get them. Somebody have come pick them up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Tyler. I'm involved with Citizens Council on Healthcare as a board member. I'm also a licensed insurance broker. I spend time, my professional time, in the individual policy, small group, and large group world, marketing to individuals more and more, since that seems to be the direction that the marketplace is going. The goal of universal coverage is something I've essentially made a profession out of, because the more people I insure, you know, the better my profession does, et cetera. And I have some things to share with you in my adventures in the marketplace that you might find interesting. And I would like to suggest that perhaps there are some alternative means that might be more effective and more cost-effective, in particular, both for the state of Minnesota, but also for the physicians, clinics, chiropractors, pharmaceutical companies on the receiving end of the benefits for people that you're trying to insure. What you do actually has a ripple effect in the marketplace. And if you are in a position of creating more and more government bureaucracies trying to cover more and more individuals, what happens is that you have more and people on government entitlement programs, whether it be Medicaid, Medicare, Minnesota Care, whatever, tend to pay the providers very poorly. In fact, there tends to be a significant hassle factor for providers to get paid at all. And one of the interesting comments I've heard from more than one provider that I insure as clients or whatever, is that, because I've asked them, what's the world like with Minnesota Care patients? They say, well, we've come to the conclusion that it's not really worth filing a claim for, because either we get paid so poorly or it isn't worth the hassle of trying to get money out of the state to pay for the claim. So it turns out to be gratis treatment on the part of the medical provider community, which is unfortunate. I think as we have more and more people on government-subsidized programs, clinics are going to have a tougher and tougher time making ends meet and what have you, especially with the aging population more and more going on to Medicare. So we need to look at the financial health of the clinics and hospitals as well as the financial health of the patients at the same time, trying to get more and more people insured. The other aspect of it is that in part of the information that I have included here, it says we're in a mess, we voted for it, talks about the growth of entitlement programs and how runaway they've become, talking about the cost, the price tag, what may be affordable today isn't affordable 10 years, 20 years from now. And I think you look at the overall cost of government and government bureaucracies and entitlements, it's getting tremendously out of hand, to say the least. The other aspect of this is from a quality care perspective, the patient who's on the receiving end of treatment through a government-subsidized program may or may not, because of the level of reimbursements, be receiving the same quality care that people receive if they have a private sector situation. Also, I receive interesting feedback from clients of mine in small group plans whose employees choose not to participate in their program because they live down the street from a hospital. they don't want to participate in any sort of premium whatsoever, whether it be Minnesota Care, their employer's group plan, individual policy, because all they have to do is walk into the emergency room, and that is where they receive their treatment. And so those are people you're not going to reach. You're not going to reach with Minnesota Care. You're not going to reach with, as long as those types of situations exist there, you're not going to reach those kinds of people. So the goal of universal coverage, there's going to be a segment of the population that will not pay a premium, period, no matter what you do. The other aspect of it is that we need insurance companies as well. And capping the growth of insurance premiums to the price of groceries, because that's part of the CPI, or the price of new cars or whatever, has nothing whatever to do with the growth of utilization of health care in the marketplace, especially in an aging population situation. So you're going to drive health insurance companies out of the state. Even worse, we're down to basically four or five major carriers in the marketplace now, where we used to have dozens. And if you create that type of environment, we're not going to have private insurers at all. The other aspect that I think is to be aware of is that the lowest major medical policy maximum that I can sell legally is $1 million. That's actually not a very large number when it comes to the price of hospitalization and long-term treatment in hospitals. $10,000, $20,000 for a single adult is a scratch when it comes to the potential cost of hospitalizations. And to lure them into a program that provides them essentially inadequate coverage with the promise of having adequate coverage just because they don't have kids is not quite, I think, the direction that that the state of Minnesota would like to go if indeed you're trying to provide coverage, proper coverage, for people out there in the marketplace. I wanted to bring to your attention, and part of the information I have for you here is the aspect of Canadian healthcare, but also the advent of H.R. 6111 that was passed at the end of last year at a federal level that also seeks to address this issue, but it seeks to address it on a private basis. It's what it is doing is providing tax parity, tax deductibility, and tax credits for the purchase of individual health insurance, presumably also that might be in tandem with health savings account programs. One of the things that I have a difficult time keeping up with professionally is writing health savings account plans. The demand is tremendous, even without the tax deductibility of the premiums. And what H.R. 6111 does is it creates the tax deductibility of premiums, creates tax credits for individuals to help afford their own individual policy and maintain some degree of dignity for themselves in the purchase of health insurance. Something I run across often is people doing their best to get off of Minnesota Care. Now, you say, well, why would you want to be off of Minnesota Care? It's, well, I don't want to be on welfare. I don't want to be in a state-subsidized program. I want to own my own policy. I want to stand on my own 2 feet. In a type of financial tax environment that the state of Minnesota, I would suggest, for the cost of running a Minnesota Care bureaucracy could do just as well, would be to assist and provide tax credits towards the purchase of individual health insurance premiums that would adequately compensate hospitals, physicians, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, maintain their affordability, even make contributions into their own privately owned individual health savings account programs that would allow them to direct their own health care and give them the same ID card to their doctor, physician, hospital, pharmacy that anybody else gives without the stigma of being on a Minnesota Care program. And I'm sorry, but it exists out there. People don't like to have to swallow their pride to go on to a state means-tested, subsidized program. And many people I've spoken to would rather not be insured than go on Minnesota Care. They just would rather not have that stigma. And so I'd like to suggest that going along with H.R. 6111, the Tax Relief and Health Care Act of 2006 that was overwhelmingly approved in a bipartisan support. This is not a partisan issue at the federal level. To see what you might do to take the money that you might have paid for an entitlement program that perhaps does expansion of government entitlements to simply supporting a private sector initiative to help afford individual policies on a tax deductibility and tax credit basis, I think it would be far more effective, especially for those providers that are trying to deliver the treatment to the individuals and get paid and maintain the doors open. And so that if they get too many government-subsidized patients, they're not in a position of having to close their doors, which happened to a major clinic in St. Paul about 7 or 8 years ago. They closed their doors because of too many, quote, government-covered patients. Their reimbursement levels were too low to maintain their open doors, and so they needed to close their doors. So all these things have an overall effect on the marketplace, both from an insurance standpoint and a provider standpoint, that I hope you will consider alternative means of helping people afford their individual health insurance and or health savings account programs.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Corey.
Mr. Chairman, I would just make a comment. I guess over the last 4 years, I've never found any of my constituents that are stigmatized, I guess that the word you used about being on Minnesota Care. I don't agree with that. And I don't agree with calling Minnesota Care welfare, because to me it's not welfare. It's giving somebody a hand up, and they're participating in paying a premium of what they can afford. You know, and so I guess I'm kind of offended by the word welfare.
I'm relating to you, Senator, what is being related to me, that it is perceived mm-hmm. that way. Minnesota Care is indeed means tested. And if they're on Minnesota Care, they're on there because they have low income situations. If they just show them a Medica card or a Blue Cross card, just like anybody else is on a small group plan or owns their own individual policy, it does need a leg up. They're not being segregated out. It's not obvious to anybody in the marketplace. So those are my experiences in the marketplace, and maybe not yours, but they are. As an insurance agent, I run to that on a daily basis.
Mr. Chair. My question, well, I want to thank you for saying that people don't want to be on welfare. I believe that most people, if given the means, or they prefer not to be on welfare, but sometimes you need to have a helping hand up. What I want to know is on the those that are moving, you said, into these HSAs, what's the average income of those people?
You know, it's all over the map because many of them are small group plans. Some of them are self-employed people. It varies all over the place. Usually what it's more related to is the cost of their prior insurance coverage. How much were they paying before for their insurance plan before, for say a non-HSA type or a low deductible or a copay plan? And they are found to be more cost effective to buy a high deductible plan and fund the difference into the health savings account than pay an ongoing high premium. So they're just all over the map. Some are lower-end people that want more control. Keeping in mind now, the average cost for a family for a high-deductible plan, it can be $200 or $300 a month. I mean, it's not, you know, so that leaves, in comparison, having a premium of well in excess of $1,000 a month for, say, a copay plan or a low-deductible type of plan, it leaves plenty of money to fund their own HSA with. Now, if that was provided in the form of tax credits or tax deductions, that would make that individual policy premium all the more affordable for those people. They wouldn't be in a position of having to need a hand up because they could do it on their own. And that's what HR 6111 actually does, is it actually provides a hand up through the tax code to help them buy their own individual policy rather than have to go on a government-subsidized program.
Thank you.
Senator Worgen, and then we'll get to discussion if there's time.
Well, Mr. Chair, it relates to the same thing that Senator Dahl was talking about. I just wanted to input in town hall meetings this weekend. There was a young man, 21 years of age. Through his employment, he could get insurance, and I think the figure was $279 per month. He's a very healthy young 21-year-old and chose not to take his employer's insurance because for $60 a month, he could carry a major medical with a $5,000 deductible, and it wouldn't take him more than 2 years to simply save that. So he opted out of his work insurance to take a major deductible. The part that I was surprised with is that he's also a college student, and he was only earning, I think, he said, $8.45 an hour. So it's a low-wage earner that saw the benefit of doing something different because it was far cheaper and he could keep more of his money.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr.
Tyler,
HR 6111?
Yes.
Is there
6111, correct.
Is there a deduction, a federal deduction?
Federal tax deduction and or credit, depending upon the income of the individual.
So if you were buying your own premium in 06?
It went into effect 2001 of 07. It was passed in 06.
Okay, so if we're buying our own private policies right now, we can take a federal tax deduction. In 08?
07.
In 07. Thank you very much.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, just a comment on that. My daughter has been buying COBRA since she graduated from college in March of 05. They run her now $415 a month. So I appreciate that information.
Sure. Thank you. Is there a discussion on the bill? Any amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand and Senator Berglund.
I have an amendment I'd like to offer. It's the A25 amendment.
While it's being distributed, perhaps you can explain it.
It's a very simple amendment. It deletes Section 1, and this is of the committee engrossment, Section 1 on page 1 of, of that engrossment, Sections 3 to 5, which is on pages 4 to 8, and Sections 8 and 9, which are on pages 9 to 11. Essentially, these are the provisions of the bill that apply the premium caps and the expenditure limits and the other kinds of what I would term to be price controls into this bill. And the reason, Mr. Chairman, and I think we've heard some, I consider, compelling testimony about the unintended consequences of doing these kinds of actions on the part of government. And frankly, I know of no case that I found on any kind of enterprise where governmental imposition of price controls or these kinds of insertions into trying to take our prejudices or our sense of judgment about what prices ought to be, they never work. They always result in some kind of interference into the role of the marketplace, and they may not be seen immediately, but they certainly do appear in some kind of distortion and add, in fact, higher costs or lower availability of the service. And so I think that there may be other things of this bill that we may need to question, but I think that we should not try to get in the business of trying to say arbitrarily this is the price or this is the cost. I think the point was well made that the costs in healthcare reflect the underlying drivers that have to do with the amount of demand there is and the kinds of technologies and the kinds of procedures that are there. And to say that we're just going to put a limit on those will only mean one thing, that those services will not be offered, or at least offered as robustly as they may be and as maybe consumers want them to be. So I would like to ask for a roll call vote on this, and I think that we should not get in the business of trying to put price controls on the marketplace.
Senator Hand's amendment to discussion. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I would urge the members of the committee to oppose this amendment. You know, when we talk about the uninsured, it's a very important problem, but it's a problem, and while it's a problem that's affecting a growing number of people in the state of Minnesota, the majority of the people in the state still have insurance. What's driving them out of having insurance is costs that are going up, double and triple digit inflation. This provision in this bill will affect those people. If we just would have had this provision since 2002, on average, we'd be saving $395 per person per policy in the state of Minnesota. There needs to be discipline imposed on the system. If there isn't, then we will simply see more and more and more people have to rely on government-subsidized programs to get their health care. So I would urge you to vote against this amendment.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hand, in just really simple language, is this the caps?
Yes, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You very much. I do agree with this.
Any further discussion? If not, on the 825 Hand amendment, Secretary will take the roll.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Berglund?
No.
Senator Dahl?
No.
Senator Erickson Ropes?
No.
Senator Fischbach? Senator Hand?
Yes.
Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Johnson?
Yes.
Senator Coring?
No.
Senator Lori?
No.
Senator Lynch? Senator Pretner Solon?
No.
Senator Torres Ray?
No.
Senator Worgen?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Lynch?
No.
On a vote of 3 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Further amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move that Senate File 2 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Aye. No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much. Thank you for all your patience.
Meeting's adjourned. Sorry. Yeah, I think there's minutes we give a little social with you.
Sorry, I'll miss.
You can't believe
it. Yeah, we'll catch you on another day.
I should give the committee the time at once, but nevertheless.
He'll get over it.
Both people
get over it.
It's all right.
I don't feel
it. It's all right.
I'm sorry.
Well, the marketplace is part of the market that's being used. We're not going to have it. I believe in people.
There really is. It's all good.
That's the way I look at it. There's cost containment.
You're subsidizing the teams.
They want to do that for themselves. I mean, I look at the professional sports. They want to impose on themselves. That's their business. But I think the government comes in and says, wow, let's say your maximum salary is $100,000. We say, well, we just don't think that these players ought to be paid that much money. Let's make it $50,000. Is that what saying that the people's salaries are just not what they're saying? We, as a group of 10 people who know nothing about it, we can decide what the price is. It's into as the one said, that the gauge of their cost, cars or a basket of food products, is paid. Things that are driving the cost of healthcare have to do with incentives and incentives for people to assume without knowing the cost. And so we're doing enough to work on the incentives of people. And all we're going to do is come along and say, we're going to limit what you can charge. What will happen if these companies are saying, and you just can't offer these benefits?
And that would be an algorithm.
To some degree. Because we've got the pressure in the marketplace to say, you can't have this cost. So what you're doing is,
plus, and you can't regulate the risk. If you can't regulate the risk, you can't. Then it's some of these costs that plans are held down to, because the plans were self-insured. When you shift it on to
the cost,
that's right, for those folks.
And so then you'll have people in private markets.
Hey.
So
how are you? I'm good.
So what you're doing is you're creating all the incentives to drive away the private market and create a larger public market. That's my point. So instead of creating market shares,
I'm sure everybody
does. I read it too.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's like, anyway, I do appreciate that. Softballs that you've thrown here.
Well, they weren't softballs. I was trying to get some information, and I appreciate your responsibility.
Thank you.